Welcome back to The Jewish Story, a Jewish history podcast for the 21st century. In this show, we'll take a look back at the history of the Jewish people, relying on historical documents, archaeologic artifacts, and linguistic data to paint a picture of the past. Last episode, we focused on the evolving structure of Ashkenazic Jewry, called the Kehillah. We explored some of the common Jewish laws and traditions around marriage, sex, and divorce, and met several prominent Jewish moneylenders of the 12th and 13th centuries. We saw the rise and fall of the baronial wars in England, and saw King Edward I rise to take the throne, beat the Jews of England into submission, and eventually expel them altogether. This week, we will turn our attention to Muslim Spain, and we'll see how critics of Maimonidean philosophy would put Judaism itself on trial. In episode 2, we touched on Jewish life in Muslim Spain under the rule of the Almohades in the 11th and 12th centuries. But remember that since the late 8th century, Christians from southern France and northern Spain had been slowly pushing the Muslims southward in their effort to recapture the Iberian Peninsula, known as the Reconquista. By the early 13th century, the territory of the Almohades had been reduced to just the southern third of Spain, with the rest being occupied by various new Christian kingdoms, such as Aragon, Navarre, Castile, Leon, and Portugal. In contrast to the often brutal life of the Jews in Muslim Spain, Jews living in these Christian kingdoms had a much more free and happy existence. This was particularly true in the Kingdom of Aragon, under the reign of King James I. After his father was killed in one of the Crusades, James was raised by the famous Knights Templar, a secret Christian society of knights whose sworn duty was to protect innocence. In 1227, at the age of 19, he retook rule of Aragon from his great-uncle and went on to become one of the most beloved kings of Aragon. James was described as a strong and handsome man, a fearless warrior, and during his rule he established solid systems of civil governance in numerous Aragonese cities. He was also known to be a particularly strong advocate for the Jews of his kingdom, who contributed significantly to the Aragonese economy as tax collectors, moneylenders, landowners, traders, and craftsmen. It was in this relatively safe environment of 13th century Christian Spain that the Zohar, one of the foundational books of Jewish mysticism, is believed to have been written. Jewish mysticism, called Kabbalah in Hebrew, had first emerged in the 1st century CE as a set of secret mystical knowledge that was passed down exclusively by mouth. But, with the publication of the Zohar, Kabbalah became codified and was able to be widely circulated. The Zohar was initially thought to have been written by a man named Shimon ben Yochai in the 2nd century, but recent historical analysis of the text, as well as 13th century testimony, suggests that its true author was Moshe de Leon, a Jew living in Christian Castile in the 13th century, where many students of Kabbalah lived. Despite the relative peace in Christian Spain, things were not so calm in France. Remember our discussion in episode 2 of Maimonides, the Jewish doctor and chacham who had published his own interpretation of the Tanakh in the late 12th century, and who died at the turn of the 13th. Maimonides' works had revolutionized Jewish thought, particularly in its attempt to merge traditional Jewish law with Greek and Roman philosophy. But European Jews were sharply divided over Maimonides' groundbreaking works. Those who admired him felt that the blending of Greek logic and philosophy with Talmudic scholarship would help non-Jews to see Judaism's value and prevent further anti-Jewish attacks. But those in opposition felt that Maimonides was diluting the purity of the Talmud, and that his works would make the ancient text appear irrelevant in the face of Western knowledge. In particular, the rabbis of southern France seemed to have a bone to pick with Maimonides, and a number of them went so far as to ban his works altogether. This book banning, championed by Rabbi Shlomo ben Avraham of Montpellier, led pro-Maimonideans to issue a cherem, coming from the same word as the Arabic haram, meaning forbidden, against him, ostensibly a total excommunication from the Jewish community. Cherems were actually ordered against a number of anti-Maimonidean rabbis, many of whom would go on to convert to Christianity. This feud over Maimonides continued to escalate over the subsequent years, and eventually reached such a fever pitch that members of the anti-Maimonidean group decided to make a dangerous play that would go on to rock the foundations of European Jewry. They decided to inform local Franciscan friars of this conflict, advising them to look into the works of Maimonides, which had until this point been relatively unknown to Christian society. The reason that involving the Franciscan friars was so dangerous was that, just as had been the case for centuries, Jews were hated and viewed as second-class citizens by the Christian Church. The only reason that they were tolerated was because of the enduring belief in St. Augustine's doctrine of witness, the idea that the ongoing existence of Jews was important in keeping the Old Testament alive. However, upon hearing how reliant Jews had become on the Talmud as a religious text, the Franciscans began to question whether the Jews had abandoned the Old Testament altogether, thus invalidating the doctrine of witness. And so, with this backdrop of intense inter-Jewish conflict about the validity of Maimonides, the increasing number of Jewish converts to Christianity, and the exposure of this conflict to the Christian Church, a new character enters our story. Nicholas Donnan, a Jew who lived in Paris in the early 13th century. Donnan was in the anti-Maimonidean camp, and in 1225 CE, he was excommunicated from the Parisian Jewish community for his views. For a decade thereafter, he remained a faithful Jew, but became increasingly uninterested and bitter towards the religion. Finally, under pressure from Christian proselytizers, and having been given the cold shoulder by his Jewish community, he converted to Christianity and joined the Franciscan order. But Donnan still had a pretty big chip on his shoulder, and made it his mission to try to destroy Judaism once and for all. He used his new Christian identity to stoke the fires of anti-Semitism, contributing to several large Jewish massacres in southern France, and in 1238 CE, he traveled to Rome to formally bring 35 charges of blasphemy against the Talmud before the Pope. Pope Gregory IX listened to the charges brought forward by Donnan and clearly felt that they had merit, for he wrote to King Louis IX about it, explaining that, quote, no punishment would be sufficiently great or sufficiently worthy of the crime, unquote. The Pope ordered all physical copies of the Talmud in Paris to be confiscated, and in 1240 CE, King Louis IX organized a formal trial at the University of Paris to determine whether the Talmud was truly guilty of blasphemy against Jesus and the Church. In this first trial against the Talmud, now known as the Disputation of Paris, Nicholas Donnan was to give arguments on behalf of the Christian Church, while various French Jews were formally summoned to Paris to argue in the Talmud's defense. We actually have a number of accounts of this trial, some Christian and some Jewish. The accounts do differ in some respects, but also have some significant agreement. Donnan's major argument against the Talmud was that Pope Innocent III's reaffirmation of Judaism as a protected religion, though as we have seen this protection was marginal at best, was made on the condition that protecting the Jews did no harm to Christianity. But, Donnan argued, because this newly revealed Talmud seemed to be offensive to Christianity, Jews may no longer deserve any such protection. The rabbis summoned to argue against Donnan, including Donnan's own former teacher, Rabbi Yechiel ben Yosef, argued that the Talmud had been around for hundreds of years and had done no harm to Christianity so far, so why was everyone so upset all of a sudden? The rabbis also seemed to do a little bit of soul-soothing, making a clear distinction between the portions of the Talmud which were viewed as halakha, or law, and those that were viewed as agada, more open to interpretation. The rabbis suggested that some of the more unsavory parts of the Talmud to the Christians were agada, not halakha, diminishing their importance. Here is where the Christian and Jewish accounts of the trial start to differ slightly. According to Christian sources, after Donnan's powerful arguments, the rabbis just broke down and confessed. But according to the Jewish version, Rabbi Yechiel and his fellow rabbis gave some pretty pithy arguments. For example, they argued that the Jesus, who the Talmud mentions standing in a boiling pile of poop in the underworld, was not Jesus of Nazareth, but rather another unspecified Jesus. After all, quote, are there not many Louis in France aside from the king? Unquote. They also argued that the Gentiles mentioned in a derogatory way in the Talmud referred to pagans, not Christians, so the Christians shouldn't be offended. Ultimately, despite the rabbis' efforts, the Talmud was found guilty of blasphemy by the jury, and King Louis IX ordered for all of the Talmudim in France to be burned. 24 cartloads of Talmudim, more than 10,000 copies, were rounded up, gathered at the Place de Grève, now the Place de l'Hôtel de Ville, and burned in the year 1242 in front of an ocean of spectators. For the Christian onlookers, this was a victory, but for the Jews, it was as if they were at a funeral. In one of his poems, or Piyutim, Meir ben Baruch of Rothenburg wrote, quote, "How could it be that you who were given in the divine all-consuming fire could be consumed by mortal fire, while your alien enemies were not even scorched by those hot coals? Moses shattered the tablets, another repeated his folly, burning the law in flames. Is this the end of the double penance? Into the public square, like booty taken from an apostate city, they burned the spoils of God on high." Unquote. The Disputation of Paris was just the first of a number of similar disputations that occurred all across Europe over the following years. The next notable one occurred in Christian-controlled Barcelona, once again following a similar format. This time, the champion in the ring on the side of the Talmud was a very famous Jewish scholar, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, nowadays known as Nachmanides. Nachmanides was born in 1194 in Girona, a city right on the border of Spain and France. He was a practicing physician, rabbi, and Jewish scholar, much like Maimonides before him, and had gained quite a bit of acclaim among Jews of Spain. In the heated feud surrounding Maimonides' works, Nachmanides took a tactful and quite moderate approach. He believed that an outright ban on the works of Maimonides would threaten Judaism's very survival, as he felt that the reason for Judaism's ongoing success was its ability to adapt to culturally diverse environments. At the same time, he argued against the excommunication of anti-Maimonideans, feeling that Jewish unity was also critical. But ultimately, Nachmanides was pulled into the ring to defend the Talmud against charges of blasphemy. The disputation was held in the city of Barcelona in 1263, when Nachmanides was already in his 70s. The Christian champion was another Jewish convert to Christianity, named Pablo Cristiani, who had devoted his life to missionary work. The trial was very public, with observers including high-ranking members of the church, leading Christian theologians, and members of the royal family, including King Jaime I of Aragon himself. We have pretty good information about this trial, both in writings from Nachmanides and a Latin account, which presents a very similar story. Although it was frankly impossible for Nachmanides to formally win the disputation, by all accounts he pretty much wiped the floor with the younger, less worldly Cristiani. He was able to deftly counter every attack leveled at the Talmud. Speaking about the Christian story of Jesus, he said, quote, "It seems a little odd that the creator of heaven and earth should have repaired to the womb of a certain Jewish woman, where he grew for 9 months, was duly born as an infant, grew, was betrayed to his enemies, and executed, restored to life, and to his place. The mind of a Jew, or for that matter anyone else, simply cannot tolerate such assertions. You, the king, have listened all your life to priests who have filled your brain with these doctrines, so that by now they are second nature to you and you accept them by pure force of habit. But if you were to encounter them for the first time as an adult, you could not possibly believe them." Unquote. He also argued that the Christian idea of the Messiah was simply incompatible with Jewish thought. Because Judaism did not believe in original sin, there was no universally guilty state from which a Messiah was required to save mankind. He explained that the Jewish Messiah, who is, quote, "not fundamental to our religion," unquote, had the role of returning Jews to Jerusalem and allowing the rebuilding of the temple. There would be nothing divine about them, and they would never assert to be so. Although he did not formally win the trial, King Jaime was very impressed with Nachmanides and paid him for his efforts. Shortly thereafter, the Bishop of Girona actually commissioned him to write a book setting down all of the arguments he had made during the trial. However, shortly after the book's publication, Nachmanides was charged with blasphemy by the Pope, forcing him to flee the peninsula and seek refuge in Jerusalem in 1267. When Nachmanides arrived in Jerusalem, he was shocked to find only two Jewish families living there, with the rest having been expelled or converted by the Muslim Ayyubid dynasty. Distressed at this, Nachmanides formed his own yeshiva and synagogue in Jerusalem, kicking off a Jewish renaissance in the area. Nachmanides ultimately died just 3 years later, in 1270 CE. We have so far focused this season in Europe and the Middle East, but as we know, by this time there were Jews living throughout Africa and along the Silk Road as well. I mentioned briefly last season the Jews of China, who we will hear more about next season. But now seems a good time to introduce the Jews of India. The first contact between Jews and India is thought to have occurred as early as the Sasanian or Macedonian periods, which we learned about all the way back in season 1. But unfortunately, those stories are lost to history. The earliest stories of Jews in India that exist come from legend and tell us of a group of 14 Jewish traders in the 1st or 2nd century CE who had gotten shipwrecked along the coast of Maharashtra, a western province of India. This group of Jews settled there and formed a community which came to be known as B'nai Israel and still exists today. Because of their location so far from the Jews of Europe and the Middle East, they were quite isolated and as a result developed some quite unique cultural practices. One notable example is that B'nai Israel in India hang rice stalks next to their mezuzot as an omen for good fortune and fertility. A second group of Jews arrived in India as refugees fleeing the First Jewish-Roman War and settled further south near the city of Kochi. These Cochin Jews prospered with virtually no persecution, and in the 11th century, a prince of the Cochin Jews was crowned by the King of India. Jews were granted full citizenship and were exempted from the standard duties and tariffs applied to other Western traders. This information comes from copper plates that have been found from the period. The Cochin Jews, though not very well connected to the rabbinic Judaism of the rest of the world, did build several synagogues, and, like the B'nai Israel, they evolved some interesting customs. For example, they developed a custom that on Friday afternoons, a candle would be lit from the Ner Tamid, which is a candle found in every synagogue that's kept constantly burning. And this light would be carried to each Jewish home, where it would be used to light oil lamps to welcome in the Sabbath. The final group of Indian Jews were the Baghdadi Jews, who settled in Kolkata on India's eastern border with Bangladesh. This community was largely made up of Jewish traders who were stationed in the area, and ultimately settled there. The three Jewish communities of India made up a thriving and very unique piece of the patchwork of Jewish life in the 13th and 14th centuries, though they were largely cut off from the rest of Jewish society, and would remain that way for some 100 years. Now that we've taken our quick detour to India, let us wander back west to the Iberian Peninsula, where a threat was rapidly rising. Before we dive into this dark chapter of Jewish history, though, let's get a quick geopolitical update. Remember that at this point in history, Iberia was split between the Christians, who by this time controlled nearly the entire peninsula, and the Muslims, who retained control of the Kingdom of Granada in the south. For decades, the Christians had been waging war on the Muslims, attempting to reconquer the entire Iberian Peninsula for themselves, an effort known as the Reconquista. Christian Iberia had been divided into four kingdoms, each ruled independently. There was Portugal in the west, Castile, Aragon, and the small kingdom of Navarre on the northern coast. The Jews living in the Iberian Peninsula were ostensibly caught in the middle of this Christian-Muslim conflict, and were left in a tenuous position. By this point, most Iberian Jews were living under Christian rule, and had a very similar relationship with the Christian kings as had the Jews in England and France. Given their history of exile and persecution, most Jews were fluent in multiple languages, including Arabic, which made them useful to the Christians as translators of Arabic texts of philosophy, medicine, and astronomy that had been compiled during the Muslim Renaissance. Furthermore, because of the hard limits placed on Jews' ability to charge interest on loans, Jewish money lending had become quite profitable and was a major source of funding for the Reconquista efforts. But the Jewish money lenders, despite their wealth, were completely at the mercy of the Christian kings. Whenever the crown was in need of a cash infusion, they would simply jack up tax rates for Jews, force immediate loan repayments, or confiscate synagogue property in order to finance their battles. It is also important to understand how the church fit into the complex relationship between the Christian kings and the Jews. Remember that the Christian church had never been particularly fond of Jews, but up until the 13th century had more or less tolerated them. This cautious tolerance was based on the idea of the doctrine of witness, which held that Jews should be allowed to live and practice their religion in order to keep the Old Testament alive. However, since the disputations of Paris and Barcelona, the doctrine of witness had essentially been abandoned, leaving the church free to persecute Jews more openly. At the same time, the Pope had become an increasingly powerful figure in European society, particularly after the Gregorian Reform movement of the late 11th century. With the rising power of the papacy and the abandonment of the doctrine of witness, Jews were in increasing danger from the Christian establishment, and their only means of protection were the kings and secular leaders of the kingdoms in which they lived. And so, the Jews of the Iberian Peninsula were balanced on a razor's edge, and the smallest gust of wind was apt to throw them into peril. In the late 13th and early 14th centuries, however, things for the Jews were, for the moment, stable. In the Kingdom of Castile, the city of Toledo had become a hub for the Jewish translation of Arabic and Hebrew literature into Latin, and later into the Castilian language, which would become Spanish. The Castilian Jews had also begun to develop their own pidgin language, known as Ladino, which quickly overtook Arabic as their lingua franca. In the Kingdom of Aragon, too, Jews were quite well treated, particularly under the leadership of King Peter IV. Christian friars were forbidden from invading synagogues to preach, something which had become ever more common. Police were prohibited from arresting Jews on holy festival days, including Shabbat, and Jews were even allowed to swear on the Ten Commandments in Christian courts. Jews had the ability to travel freely throughout the Kingdom of Aragon, and would frequently set up their own Jewish quarters in various towns and cities. And of course, they had a wide range of occupations open to them, not just money lending and trade, but also in metalwork, wine selling, and bookbinding, among others. As for Christian citizens themselves, there seemed to have been mixed feelings about the Jews. Some were quite fond of them, preferring to see a Jewish doctor over a Christian one, for example. But others had grown sick of how reliant the kingdom had become on the Jews, blaming them for their problems, and eagerly taking place in anti-Jewish riots whenever they had an excuse. In the mid-14th century, the Iberian Peninsula was rocked by two big events that would serve as catalysts for an uptick in Jew hatred. The first of these came in 1348, when an epidemic of a deadly infectious disease known as the Black Death ravaged the peninsula. The disease had been brought over to Europe from East Asia by rats who snuck aboard Mediterranean trading ships, and, once it infected its human host, would cause the sudden appearance of fever and large, painful welts all over the body, leading to a torturesome death. The Black Death quickly tore through Iberia, killing thousands, and the Church of the Crown seemed completely unable to stop it, leading to mass panic among the population. Listeners today, having just gone through the COVID-19 pandemic, will easily recognize the feeling that 14th century Iberians must have had, and the social upheaval the epidemic would have caused. The Christian kingdoms were hurting and afraid, and, as tends to happen when disaster strikes, they were eager for someone to blame. Enter the Jews. In 1349, in the midst of a second wave of Black Death, rumors began to spread throughout Christian Iberia that it had been the Jews who had brought the Black Death to Christian Spain, rumors that culminated in a deadly anti-Jewish riot in Toledo. Just 10 years later, a second excuse for Jew hatred sprung up in the form of a contest for succession of the throne of Castile between King Pedro I and his half-brother, Enrique. As part of his campaign, Enrique branded Pedro as King of the Jews, a title meant to turn the Castilian people, who were still resentful in the wake of the Black Death, against him. This charge was reinforced by Pedro's friendship with a wealthy Jewish treasurer named Shmuel, who had just spent a large sum of money building a beautiful synagogue in Toledo. This campaign against Pedro, rooted in Jew hatred, struck a chord with many Christians, those who believed the myth that Jews had been responsible for the Black Death, and many of the poorer folk of Castile, and they came out in droves against Pedro. Fearing for his crown and needing to do something to appease his critics, Pedro had his Jewish friend Shmuel arrested and executed in a desperate attempt to distance himself from his Jew-loving image. Throughout the decade-long feud between the two brothers, Enrique stoked numerous violent anti-Jewish riots across Castile, including one in 1367, during which almost 1,000 houses in Toledo's Jewish quarter were burned to the ground. The feud finally came to an end 2 years later, when Enrique murdered Pedro and took the throne for himself. After Enrique's ascension to the throne, things ironically seemed to settle down briefly. A new wave of Jewish immigration into Toledo occurred, and a second Jewish quarter was set up, within which Jews had a good deal of independence. New synagogues were built, as well as 5 new Jewish primary and secondary schools. But just as things in Castile had started to cool off, a fanatic was on the rise who would once again spell big trouble for the Jews. The man's name was Ferrand Martinez, a prominent priest who had once been the private minister to the Queen Mother of Aragon, and had since become the archdeacon of the Spanish city of Ecija. In 1378, Martinez launched a campaign across Christian Spain, preaching against the Jews. He traveled from town to town, urging all who would listen to tear down synagogues, and to forcibly convert or kill all of the Jews in their cities. But although he gained a bit of a cult following, Martinez was still largely considered a fanatic, and his wild sermons had no real backing from any powerful figure. King Enrique, after being pressed by Jewish leaders, ordered Martinez to retract all of his anti-Jewish statements and cease and desist from further preaching. The civilian church was equally horrified, labeling Martinez a heretic and denying his affiliation with the church. The Toledo Jews even successfully requested a condemnation of Martinez from the Pope himself. But none of this would stop Martinez. He continued his work as a traveling preacher until the year 1390, when King Enrique's 11-year-old grandson took the Castilian throne. Too young to properly rule, a significant power vacuum suddenly opened, and Martinez took the opportunity to amplify his message. He publicly ordered the churches of Castile to destroy all synagogues in the kingdom, and began to whip up angry mobs across Castile, which became more and more aggressive. In March of 1391, he launched an actual physical assault on the Jews of Seville, which had to be stopped by the mayor himself. As punishment, the two main ringleaders of the attack were publicly whipped in the city's main square, but an angry throng of Martinez supporters gathered and swarmed the mayor, chasing him from the square and freeing the two mob leaders. A few months later, in Toledo, a crowd of angry youth who had been radicalized by Martinez forced open the gates of the city's Jewish quarter, killing thousands of Jews. The women and children were either forcibly baptized, or, if they resisted, had their throats cut. Many of the smaller synagogues were burned to the ground, and the larger ones were plundered for their gold and silver. When the violence was over, and Toledo's Jewish quarter was purged, many of the larger synagogues were converted to churches, including one which still stands today, the Church of San Bartolomé. Having started in Castile, the anti-Jewish pogroms began to spread into the neighboring kingdom of Aragon. In 1410, 250 Jews were murdered in the coastal city of Valencia, and soon after the violence spread up the coast to Catalonia, and finally, in the summer of 1410, to Barcelona, where the city's entire Jewish population was either forcibly converted, killed, or martyred. We actually have a first-hand account of the Barcelona massacre, written by Rabbi Chasdai ben Avraham Crescas, the unofficial chief rabbi of Valencia. He writes, quote, "Using bows and catapults, they fought against the Jews gathered in the citadel, beating and smashing them in the tower. Many sanctified the name of God, among them my own son, an innocent bridal lamb. Some slew themselves, others jumped from the tower, whose limbs were already broken before they reached halfway down. Many came forth and killed themselves on the open street, and all the rest converted, with only a few finding safety. And because of our sins today, there is no one left in Barcelona called an Israelite." Unquote. Hearing about the violence in Valencia and Barcelona, the Jewish leaders of Majorca went to the royal governor to beg for his protection. The governor did what he could, tucking the Jews away in their Jewish quarter and locking the gates. But before long, an army of 7,000 men, flying flags displaying the cross, appeared, joined by a rogue gang of bandits. After trying and failing to calm down the ever more belligerent crowd, the governor of Majorca fled in a panic, allowing the mob to break through the gates and lay waste to the Jewish quarter. Within 2 days, there were at least 300 Majorcan Jews dead, including many women and children. Just as they had in all of the other Spanish towns, the mob looted the synagogues and tore up and burned Torah scrolls. Some of the remaining Jews agreed to be baptized to save themselves from a brutal death. Unfortunately, these Iberian pogroms against the Jews were only setting the stage for what was to come. Next episode, we will delve into one of the darkest periods in European Jewish history and learn of a genocidal event that would change the landscape of the Jewish world forever. That's coming up next week on The Jewish Story.